Hi, good evening, everybody. Tonight is December 31st.
What year?
2022, but not for too much longer. This is our fifth in the week session, and it's we're going to be talking about Rav Nachman Mbreslov. There's a lot to talk about him. He's one of the Hasidic Rebbes, he probably has one of the largest influences of people today. Just one thing I just want to say before I start is we're going to talk about his life. We're not going to wrestle with any of these other Hasidic Rebbes. Chas v'shalom, I don't want to in any way come across in any negative way. So if I do, it's totally, it's not intentional, and you know. So I just wanted to say that to begin with. So please even tell me that it may not be negative. It may be negative, or you know. But I only want to just bring it out in a positive way. We're going to speak about Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman there's a lot of controversy about Rav Nachman and the Breslovers, Hasidim in general. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about it. But we're going to talk about, I just want to talk about Rav Nachman and his, his life and things that happened to him during his life. Okay, there is one thing I want to talk about, and that is, before I even start, Rav Nachman had one of his Hasidim, was a person by the name of Nussen Steinhartz, if I'm saying his name correctly. And Rav Nussen Steinhartz is the one that wrote all about Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman told him, I want you to write about my life, and I want you to write, he wrote his Torah, his Chedushim as well. And he wrote three or four different Sfarim. One of them, as you can see here, is the Chayei Moran, and there's the Shivchei Moran. There's also Likutei Moran. So a lot of these slides here are going to be quoting from his different Sfarim. Again, I get a lot of these slides. I get a lot of my information from Rabbi Irons, who is the Rosh Kollel in Detroit. And what Rabbi Irons does is he gets his information from Sfarim, from Jewish sources. So he's done a lot of the research. Okay, so Rav Nachman Mbreslov, it's just remarkable what he accomplished about himself. We're gonna just see that even as a kid, he was doing things that adults don't even do. And when he was doing things that adults, for sure, he was doing things that for sure adults don't do. So, he probably was some Gilgal of some great, great, great soul. As you'll see, the things that he does is mind-boggling. He was born in Mezhevizh. Okay, and Mezhevizh was the place where the Baal Shem Tov, that's where the Baal Shem Tov lived, that's where the Baal Shem Tov died. That was the center of Hasidus for the Baal Shem Tov. When the Maggid of Mezerich took over, he moved everything to Mezerich. But Mezhevizh was where the Baal Shem Tov was. Now, the Baal Shem had, I don't know if it's going to be on another slide, but the Baal Shem Tov's Rav Nachman was the Baal Shem Tov's great grandson. The Baal Shem Tov had a son, I think it was Rav Nussen, somebody who took over for a year, but he also had a daughter. His daughter was Adel. It standed for something, and I don't remember what it standed for. I'm not trying to remember, Adel, his daughter, I believe, was married to Rav Nachman Horodenka, which was a close Talmud of the Baal Shem. and they had a daughter, and her husband, she was also married, and they, I think the husband died early. They had the Reb Nachman wasn't from Breslov then, and then the husband died. I'm not sure if they both his parents died or his father died, and he was really brought up by his grandparents. And he was brought up, and when eventually he also grew up in the house of the Baal Shem. And okay, it says over here in 17, what does it say over here where it was? He was born, I forgot the year, well, let's go back a bit. 1772 it probably was, because it was 1772. He was born, and he lived for 38 and a half years. So he was very, very young when he died. He was born at the time, just when the ban came out. So in other words, the day of his bris was the day that the Ashkenazim made the ban against the Hasidim. So that would be 1772. When he grew up, so what basically, what mainly many people had, what happened is many of the Talmidim of the Besht and the Baal Shem Tov and other great people would come to Mezhevish to go to the kever of the Baal Shem. And when they came there, they most of the time they stayed in the house of the Baal Shem Tov. So Reb Nachman grew up with all of these stories of great stories, these tzaddikim that would stay in the house and they would tell over stories of his great-grandfather and other stories, and that what had a, he said about himself, had a tremendous, tremendous impression on himself. It says, now again, this is from the Shivchei Maram. Again, these are different Sfarim, and a lot of them is about he was told, Reb Nachman Steinhardt wrote this about Reb Nachman. He writes that when Reb Nachman was very young, so there's a, you know, we say Shvisi Hashem Lenegdi Samed. So there's a pasuk in Tehillim, you should put Hashem in front of you always. So what does that mean? So to some people it means that you're constantly thinking of Yud Kei Vav Kei. You're constantly thinking of Hashem in front of him. So it says that at some point of Reb Nachman as a child, he was thinking so much about putting Hashem's name in front of him that he wasn't concentrating on his studies. He wasn't concentrating on the Gemara, and his Rebbe got upset with him. Okay, but I guess it wasn't for too long, because it also says that Reb Nachman said about himself that when he was trying to learn and study, whether it was Mishnayos or Gemara or Shulchan Aruch or Halacha, or Zohar, every time he started to learn something, he found that it was very hard for him to concentrate, and he wasn't able to, and he would cry, and he would daven to Hashem that Hashem should open up his mind, his heart. And that's going to be, we're going to see a lot about davening. That was like a hallmark of Reb Nachman Mbreslov, that, you know, davening and different tefillos that he would say and things he would do. At some point, I think he was about 6 years old, probably even maybe even a little older as well. It says he used to give his Rebbe extra money to teach him extra dafim of learning. So his father would pay the malami, and then I guess Reb Nachman Mbreslov would get money like to buy candies or stuff, and he would give it to his Rebbe to teach him extra Gemara. And it worked. And then he learned extra every day. Okay, and he had an extremely, extremely schedule of learning. The amount that he would learn every day, Talmud, Poskim, Tanakh, Yaakov, Zohar, Tikkunim, the Arizal, Musar. I wouldn't say mastered them all, but yes, he was very, very learned, very, very learned in all of these, as well. Again, Shivchei Maran says that he mastered them all. He knew all of these svarim. Okay, and this is also was a hallmark of Nachman, and I think it's a hallmark of the Breslover Hasidim as well, and that they spend time davening different tefillos and constantly davening, secluding themselves, and either you know hispodidus, and davening. He would he also would find different tefillos. Not only would he daven in from the Siddur, but if he would look around for different tefillos that there are around. We have a tefillah today for Rosh Chodesh, you know, Rosh Chodesh Sivan, you're davening for children. And he would find, you know, other different types of tefillos from all over, to he would daven those. He would also daven tefillos in Yiddish, not only in Hebrew, in the Siddur, but he would also daven tefillos with all the different, any language. And it also says that there are some Hasidim, when they would daven tefillos, they would think of certain high things, Kabbalistic things. They would think of Kabbalistic formulas or like different spheres, the spheros. But I think Rav Nachman was very into just davening the simple explanation of what the words were. He wasn't into, when you're davening, to think of all high different level types of things. And I think even today, the Breslover Hasidim, the real Breslover Hasidim, they spend a lot of time with their davening, with their hispodidus as well. He composed his own prayers in Yiddish and would pray, daven to Hashem for all these for Hashem to help him, serve him, and he himself said about it that he merited many of his things. Whatever he merited was due to his tefillos.
Rabbi, who wrote this?
Okay, so this Shivchei Moran was one of three or four Sfarim written by his student Nassan Steinhardt.
Okay,
so, and that was also very unique about, very different, and maybe that's, you know, part of the controversy of Rav Nachman, because generally Gedolim don't speak about them. I don't think there's any Gedol today that called up Art Scroll and said, when are you making a biography about me? You know, right? I mean, and that's basically what he did. He went to this person, his student, and he says, I want you to write Svarim about me, about what I do and what I accomplish. He talked about himself, or what this is what he did, these are things that he accomplished. Something which is not, again, it's not the norm. It's not like, you know, very, very few people talk about themselves and what they did and what they accomplished. But he did. He talked about this, he had a lot of stories and mashalim and things that, but he did that, he would do that a lot. We mentioned, okay, he would, as a child, he was also like a hidden tzaddik. So when he was out in public as a child, what would he do? He'd like, you know, he'd play ball and he'd be wild, and people would look at him and say, come on, this kid, he's a nut, he's a wild, you know. My grandmother used to call me like a wildechaya, you know, like a wild kid just running around. And that's what he did. He did it on purpose, in order for people not to have any ideas of what he was. And this is like, even at the early ages, I think he writes, how old was he? Was around maybe even six, or starting at least from 6 years of age. He used to his father would give him a large coin, and then he would, if this is the things that he would do, he'd break the large coin into a lot of small coins, and he would secretly go to the shul, go to the Beis Medrash, and then he would get a pushka box. And he would say a shem yichud. He'd make a yichud like a, I'm doing a mitzvah, giving tzedakah, and he'd give a coin. And then he would do the same thing. I'm doing the mitzvah, giving, and he'd give a coin. And he would constantly be looking to constantly doing giving tzedakah. Okay, that's like one type of a thing that he would do. He didn't want to get pleasures from this world, even as young as a child. So what would he do? He would take the food. He couldn't fast as a child. He realized, I guess even as a child, realized that that would not, he couldn't do that. So when he would eat, he would just swallow his food without chewing it, so he wouldn't get benefit from it. And I guess that's the, again, Shifchei Maran, that's what it says about him. This is also a little bit, this was also sort of controversial. You'll see this in later on also. He would visit the grave of the Baal Shem Tov, and like it says, again, Shifchei Maran says, visit the grave of the Baal Shem Tov and ask him to help him draw it closer to Hashem. He would, okay? That is what is sort of controversial. It's not so partial, I think many people say, when we go to Kvarim to daven by Tzaddikim, we're not davening to the Tzaddik to help us. You know, we're davening to Hashem in the merit of the Tzaddik, in the honor of the Tzaddik. But it's not like Baal Shem Tov, please help me. Like, he's just a neshama. But it sounds like that's how he did. He actually later on, when he was married and he was living elsewhere, he went to the grave of another tzaddik to ask him to get the Baal Shem Tov to help him. Like it was again, this is, I mean, he did it, so I guess there's a makor for that, but I think many people say when you go to a cemetery, that's how we're davening. We daven to Hashem. We don't daven to the tzaddikim.
Yeah.
We daven in the merit of the tzaddikim. We're in a holy place. It's a cemetery. The neshamas are there, and that's what we should do. There it says over here. His practice was, again, he was a kid. He used to go at night to the cemetery, and then from there to the mikvah. There were two mikvahs. One was outside, and as you can imagine, in Ukraine, it gets cold at night in the winter, and he was freezing, and he would go from the Besht's grave, he'd go to the cemetery at night, and he would just go to the mikvah. He'd be freezing, and it says over here, one time, he was only six when he started this, and he did it in secrecy. One time he came back, and his payas was still wet, and people saw him, they thought he just washed his hair. What are you, it's 10 degrees outside and you're washing your hair? What a fool. They thought he was like, dim-witted. What type of kid is this? He's like, there's no seichel. Meanwhile, he's going to the mikvah, and he did this all secrecy. Turned 13, and of course, what does every good 13-year-old boy do in Europe? Gets himself married. He went to his uncle. He had an uncle, his uncle, Rabbi Ephraim, the chief rabbi of Siddelkov. He told him, come, and he spoke to him, taught him lessons. There were certain things which he held in esteem, and he basically married him off to a daughter of, what does it say over here on the next slide? Next slide is the daughter of a businessman, Rebbe Fryer. He was married in the city of Medvedevka. His father-in-law was a very chashuv person. He was rich and he had a good name. And he lived in Medvedevka for quite some time, for a few years. And that time, as he started getting married, he wanted to serve Hashem more. And he used to influence the people around him. He would go back to Mezhevizh for every so often. And then when he was there, he started his fasting. And that was as he had a practice of fasting. Sometimes he would fast the entire week, from week to week. And he made his wife swear, it's probably on the next one, hold on. He would make his wife swear that she wouldn't tell anybody, you know, and he had all different techniques and tricks how nobody else would find out that he was swearing, that he was fasting, and he would fast for many, many weeks, you know, sometimes even 2 weeks. On Shabbos he would eat, and then he would go on to fast again. Again, this is where I told you he went to the grave of Rabbi Shadyano in Smela to speak to the tzaddik and ask him to go inform the Baal Shem Tov. I mean, could you get to me, the Baal Shem Tov. So, again, that's what he did. He would take, he was into his spodidus, being by himself and thinking of what he should be doing in davening. And like he, when things are practiced, it says, this is in the Sichos Maran. The Sichos Maran, he brings down that he would go into a boat, he couldn't row very well, and that's it. He would find himself, he would row back and forth again, all in his boat of this, and that's how he would, his praying, and that's how he would get close to Hashem. Seclude himself in the forest. Okay, and now it goes into what he learned. He says he learned the Shulchan Aruch 3 times. I guess he must have been, like, I don't know if it's a photographic memory, but he must have been, his mind was open to remember this all. He went through it once simply, and then he went through it a second time with all of the Gemaras. You know, when you go to the Shulchan Aruch are just the laws. Where does the Shulchan Aruch get the laws from? He gets the laws from the Gemaras. So the first time he went through the Shulchan Aruch. The second time he went through the Shulchan Aruch with all the Gemaras. So he went through the source material. And the third time, he went through it with all its underlying Kabbalistic principles. I have no idea what that means, but it seems it was a different way of connecting it with Kabbalah, which and he this remained with him. He would also study so much. At the end of his life, he told, this is what, you know, he said, this is what people should study. It was clearly it wouldn't be enough time in the day to study as much as he studied. Okay, that, and you just see that's in an hour he would learn many folios of Shulchan Aruch with all the commentaries, Turis of Magen Avraham, Berel Golub, Reish Chodesh, Ateres Kanan, depending on, not all of them, these Mefarshim are in every volume, but whatever there was, he would do it. He said when people would spend time preparing to daven, he would be reviewing Shulchan Aruch. Okay, he also said that every year people should complete all of Shas. And it would take Shas, Daf Yomi does it in about 6.5 years. Right, so he said every year you should do it also with the Riff and the Rush. Okay, not only that, but you should also do the Shulchan Aruch with all its commentaries, all of Midrashim, all of the Zohar literature, which is Zohar Tikkunim, Zohar Chadash, and all the writings of the Arizal, and just about once a year you should finish all that. I mean, it's in addition, okay, you should spend time studying in depth. That's just the keys. But then you have to learn in depth, and you take Tehillim as well as all the different types of davening. Okay, he also said that even a person who doesn't learn so much, he could become a great person, but he did feel that scholarship is very, very important. I think also that's a little bit where he would get in controversies with other rebbes. But the other rebbes were saying, overall, the Hasidism, it was like you had different, the rebbes had special neshamas. And like we mentioned many times, the success or the shefa, the bracha that people would get would be connecting to a rebbe. So you had these special neshamas, these rebbes, and you would connect to them, and everybody would benefit. And Reb Nachman held there wasn't such a big difference between the rebbes and the chassidim and their followers. It's not always that you know. Not just the special neshamas of the rebbes, and you know, it wasn't a from all the chassidim. That wasn't the main understanding. Was like the other way. Not that the rebbes had a higher level. There was certain level, higher level neshamas. Okay, and this is what I mentioned before. There were times where He would fast, you know, a week at a time and eat on Shabbos. He says it was 1 year he did the entire week 18 times. It's 52 in a week, in a year, 52 weeks in a year. 18 would have been more than a quarter, right? Almost like about a third. A third of the year he did from week to week. And he was very thin. He was very sickly, weakly, sick, you know, and physically he wasn't very, very strong. But this is the way he conducted himself. Again, not the way that the Baal Shem told, you know, had, this wasn't the chassidus of the Baal Shem Tov, his great-grandfather. It wasn't about abstaining from this world, but it was about enjoying the world and using the world to serve Hashem. Again, off different than from the main chassidim understanding. Again, nobody was, I told you, nobody was aware of it. He would think of himself as if he had died, and he would, you know, think of the Yom HaMisa. And he said, again, this is like somebody, he said about himself, and he succeeded in, he succeeded in subduing every defective character, trait, and every desire. Okay? Like, that's what he said about himself, I guess. Again, like, not usually that people would say that about themselves. If they did do it, they would hide it. He said also that he did it at such a young age. And he started mentioning other people that removed all of their taivas, all of their worldly desires. For them, it took many, many years to do it. In their old age, they were able to do it. You know, as a person gets older, his desires are not so strong, and he had many, many years to work on it, but he himself said he was able to do it in a very, very short amount of time. What did he do? He said that food is, he showed his ways. He looked at food, it's revolting to him, he couldn't eat food, and also marital relations. He spoke about himself. He said that he was able to remove from himself all material desires. Sichus Maran, 171. Okay. Now came this. This was a change in Nachum's life. He went to Eretz Yisrael, and you could have made a book. You could write a movie, but you could make like a book of all his adventures. His adventures were everywhere he went. There were plagues, there was war, and things, like terrible things were happening. And he ended up going to Eretz Yisrael, and he felt that he himself, that trip in Eretz Yisrael changed him and made him into a much, much better, higher level person that he would have ever been able to accomplish had he not been in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, that's what he said about himself. He did this trip in 1798, 1799. That's during 6 months in that time. He was for 6 months in Eretz Yisrael. And when he came back, he was on a much, much higher level. And that's when he may have his main start with his following. In other words, he may have always had a following, but his following was much smaller. But when he came back from Eretz Yisrael, that's when he started his following, including Reb Nosson Steinhardt's, came after 1798. Okay, so he decided that he was going to go to Eretz Yisrael, and he said about himself again, in Likutei Maran. Likutei Maran is more of his Torah, his learning. Again, Nosson Steinhardt took the Sefer of Likutei. So in the preface, he talks about going to Eretz Yisrael, and he says the Torah which he revealed after his travels to Eretz Yisrael was immeasurably greater than the Torah which he revealed before that, which in itself was astounding and awesome. Before then, his learning was unbelievable. But after he came back, we're talking about a totally different level. Okay. His family heard he wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, and they cried. They said, "Don't do it! Don't do it!" He said, "That's it. I'm doing it." He actually said about he said about the Vilna Gaon, the Besht wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, and the Vilna Gaon wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael. He quoted somebody else, probably in a later slide, I have it here, that they all turned back. He said the challenges to get to Eretz Yisrael was so great that they couldn't do it, and they turned back, but he himself was able to do it. So his first main stop on the way to Eretz Yisrael was Istanbul. He says when he got to Istanbul, he went with one attendant. That's who he went with. When he got to Istanbul, he started to act like a child. Mom's childish behavior, he started to act like foolish, and he used to do crazy things. He used to dress in torn clothing, go barefoot. He used to make like childish games, and he used to make like he's play fighting with other people. There was actually somebody, two people from his hometown, they said, isn't that Nachman Mbreslov? And he did things that was so crazy off the charts that these two people wouldn't even believe it.
Why?
Oh, so why? Because he said about it, as he says, here it is, he says that the Besht, the guy in Rav Naftali, I'm not sure which Rav Naftali he was talking about, they were unable to come to Eretz Yisrael because of the obstacles they encountered. And he too encountered the same obstacles, but he withstood them. This was due a great measure to the childishness that he affected, and without it, it would have been impossible. I heard in the name of our master that before a person can achieve greatness, he must first fall to a level of katnus. Since being in Eretz Yisrael can bring the greatest of all heights, the Baal Shem Tov, Sal was not able to come there as he couldn't lower himself to be a childish behavior. So that's, again, this is what the Rav Nachman Breslov held. He said, I have to lower myself because in order to get to Eretz Yisrael, to get that high level, he lowered himself. This is what he did. This is what he said about himself. Moving on, it says that sure enough, he came to Eretz Yisrael. They came, doesn't say too much here, at least, about on the way there. He got to Eretz Yisrael, Erev Rosh Hashanah. The day before Rosh Hashanah, they said they came to Slichus, they came to Haifa, that's where the port was. They went to the Cave of Eliyahu, Marat Eliyahu. I've been there, as anybody has, I'm sure. That's where they take you there. Was Eliyahu really there? Maybe not, but at least it's called the Cave of Eliyahu. Okay, afterwards he davened Shacharis, and then they went to the holy city of Haifa. Now it was then our holy teacher entered the Holy Land. He came to the place which he longed for and desired, and he put himself in danger many times. He said the human brain cannot begin to fathom the depths of joy that he felt at that moment. Okay, so he describes that he was very, very happy. For all at once, as soon as he walked but 4 cubits in the Holy Land, he achieved all that he had originally set out to achieve. In the early afternoon, they went to the mikvah and afterwards to the synagogue and waited there till nightfall. I guess it's the Erev Rosh Hashanah. When our master came to his place of lodging, he was bursting with joy and repeatedly told his attendant, how fortunate you are to be with me at this moment. He then told him to read the list of names of the followers who submitted their names, and he prayed for them. They ate the Rosh Hashanah meal and continued to rejoice until they fell asleep. In the morning they went to the shul, and after they came home from the services, Rav Nachman was overcome with severe depression and anxiety and didn't speak to anyone at all. Okay? This is Sikhe Moran, and it's all about his trip. Right after Rosh Hashanah, he expressed a desire, let's go back home. He had absolutely no desire to travel any place, not to Sfat, not to Tiberia, because Sfat and Tiberia and Yerushalayim, these were the three main places that there were Jews at the time. And again, we're talking 1798. This is just about the time when the French would attack and take over Akko. So just about the time when this is all going to happen. However, he had his attendant. Okay, now he said, however, his very strong desire to feast his eyes on the sights of Eretz Yisrael. As soon as the residents of Sfat and Tiberia heard that he had arrived, they sent messengers, come to us. The emissaries of Tiberia arrived right before Yom Kippur, brought them letters that they should come for Sukkot. He didn't pay any attention. Chol HaMoed, the entire community, including our master, went to the cave of Eliyahu HaNavi. Rav Nachman Horovitz did not feel any joy. He just sat there with great humility, broken heart. Rav Zev Wolf, so I guess Rav Chassid, who knew them, said, he went to the attendant, what's with your master? Why is he so down? Simchas Torah, again, he was still not participating. He was very in some sort of melancholy. Even though I had previously decided to tarry a little bit longer, my deep feelings was Eretz Yisrael. He now said to his attendant, after Simchas Torah, I now want to travel back home. Go book passage on a boat, which will be traveling to Istanbul. The attendant had no desire to listen to him and immediately go back home. He wanted to go to Tveria. Our master replied, since you have such a strong desire to go to Tveria, go and hire in donkey drivers and take us there. Rav Nachman would never stubbornly persist to have his own way. The attendant went ahead, hired a donkey driver, and they arrived in Tveria before nightfall. Okay, now we're after Sukkot. So up until Sukkot, he was in Haifa. And now, after Sukkot, they came to Tveria. When they got to Tveria, everybody came to his house. So one by one, person after person the entire night came to speak to Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman, he did not, the famed Rav Holy Rav Avram of Kalisk. He was also one of the Talmidim of the Besh, sent him a message excusing himself for not personally coming. He was basically, he bloodlet. He was doing something, he wasn't well. Our master replied that he was planning in any case to personally visit him. Soon after, Rav Avram of Kalisk invited him for Shabbos. And he said, okay, he accepted. The next day, someone came to pick him up. And for the very first Shabbos, Parshas Noach, Rav Nachman spent by Rav Avram Kalisk. And now it goes on to show the meeting between the two of them. You know, Rav Avram Kalisk bent his head Rav Nachman bent his head that Rav Avram of Kalisk should bless him. And he jumped back. He says, what? I'm going to bless you. You bless me. In any case, they wouldn't, but the pshara was that they would bless the attendant. So, he refused to bless him because he said, I'm going to bless you. You're going to bless you. So, all right, I'll bless your attendant. That's what happened. Rav Avram he asked Rav Nachman to give the speech. Rav Nachman refused. Rav Avram of Kalisk himself gave the discourse. He spoke very high speech, a high screeching voice. Nobody could really understand, and he ended his speech with, this is the essence of the service of the Creator. So, but later, in the future, Rav Nachman would praise that speech of Rav Avram of Kalisk, even though, he said about Rav Avram Kalisk, I've seen many tzaddikim, but only the holy tzaddik Rav Avram actually achieved perfection. He was also, I guess, Rav Nachman, I think, was somewhat critical, like I said, of a lot of the Hasidim, a lot of the movements, and even a lot of some of the other rebbes, which I guess could have also caused controversy with him. Okay, when he was there, he went to his grandfather, Rav Nachman Haradenka, who was buried in Tveria. He went to his grave. He then finally ordered his attendants to go to Haifa, book passage. So he went, and when he got there, it was a ship that was bringing the Gaon of Shepetavka and a rabbinic emissary. So again, the Yishuv and Eretz Yisrael, how did they get their money? They got their money from Europe. So they were constantly sending people to Europe. They would collect money and they would bring it back to Eretz Yisrael. Now, on this boat in particular, they felt that they were like spies or they were informants in the boat who knew that these rabbis had a lot of money, and these rabbis were afraid that if they would, when they would travel from Haifa to Tveria, they would be robbed. So what did they do when they saw the attendant of Rav Nachman Breslov there? They said, "We're giving you the money. You take the money and you go back to Tveria, because they won't think that you weren't on the boat with us." So and that's exactly what they did. They gave him the money, and he returned, instead of booking passage home, he returned with the money of these emissaries. And then when he came back, Rav Nachman said, it seems that Hashem still wants me here. And then he told him to take He wanted to go to Jerusalem, where Rav Kalisk said, don't go. I'm not sure why not. It could have been there was a plague there. It could be it was just dangerous to go there. Could have been, but for whatever reason, he didn't end up going. Now, there was something between the Tzaddik of Shabbatavka and Rav Avram of Kalisk. There was some disagreement between the two, and it he actually made peace, some sort of a peace between the two. He made peace between the Rav of Shabbatavka and the Holy Rav of Kalisk. Again, I guess you can imagine, if money is coming in, so, like, how do you divide the money? If, let's say, most of the money came from a place where Rav Avram Kalisk was, or where the Tzaddik of Shabbatavka. So, how do you divide it? Divide it based on who brought the money in, or Tzaddik of Shabbatavka, he's the one that went back. So, whatever there was, it was some sort of a disagreement how to divide it, and Rav Nachman made peace between the two. We're going to see also there's going to be a machlokas between Rav Avram of Kalisk and Rav Shneur Zalman of Leidy, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he's going to also, we'll see about that as well. And as he was still there, an epidemic broke out in the city. So now you have an epidemic, and they locked the city. They didn't want anybody to leave. I guess the Turks that ran the country said nobody's leaving. So he tried to go out through a cave. He went to a cave. He found himself on the wall of the city. He was going to jump off the other side. He realized that the wall was over the water. Had he jumped, he probably would have died. So he had to somehow get back. And somehow he escaped from the city. And he made his way back to Sfat when he found out that the French were about to attack Akko. So now, let's get back on the boat. Let's start getting home. Problem is, he got on a boat, and it wasn't a regular boat, it was a warship. So he got on a Turkish warship. Now, normally when you're on a Turkish warship, Turks would, no problem taking Jews, selling them, and, you know, to Muslims or whoever, for as captives. So here he is, he's the only two Jews, and all you have is an entire army. It's a warship, you know. Well, what do you do on a warship? It made its way. Finally, it made its way on the 14th of Nisan. So, again, this is probably about 6 months. So this is probably he got on the boat. I'm not sure if he got on the boat around Nisan, but it was probably about a few weeks on the boat. It made its way to Rhodes. When they got to Rhodes, they realized it was a Jewish community in Rhodes. So for some reason they let the attendant off the boat. And this is, he got in 14th, this is Erev Pesach. So now Erev Pesach, he's in Rhodes. He presents himself to the rabbi of the Jewish community. The rabbi says, the first thing is go back on the boat, get all your money off. That's the first thing. So he went back on the boat, got all his money off, and came back to the rabbi. They were hoping, at least, you know, Rav Nachman and his attendant get some matzahs, wine, you know, this is for Pesach. But the community had something else in mind. He says, so they were on the boat for the first days of Pesach, but then Rav Nachman's attendant went to the Chacham, who ordered secretly, afterwards the Chacham, together with two wealthy members of the community, spoke with the ship's captain. He said, deliver us these two souls. Now, this is what the captain replied. What connection do you have with these people? I took possession of them myself. He then proceeded to give a detailed account of the difficulties they encountered on the way and told them, that's not all. There was an instant that they didn't experience danger. We could have drowned these souls or sold them to Muslims or take possessions of all their belongings and money, and no one would have said anything in protest. But what could we do? They carry with them a mazel that reaches into the heart of the heavens. Not only did God make a miracle on their behalf so that the ship arrived here so quickly, but God also took control of my mind and my better judgment, and I let one of them enter the city. Because of all this, I certainly have no right to take their money. To pacify my servants, however, give me 200 thaler and take them off the ship. And that's what happened. They immediately gave him the money, as he demanded, and saved them from death or slavery. So now they're in Rhodes. And after Pesach, they passed passage on a ship to Istanbul. They gave him a letter of recommendation, and unknown to them, the ship which they took was filled with many Greeks, among whom an epidemic had broke out. Now they're on a ship with an epidemic. First a warship, and now a ship with an epidemic. Although they were unaware the reason they saw people dying, a strong wind carried them to the port of Istanbul very quickly. They were there for 10 days. They traveled to Galati in Romania. The ship reached the city and on an island in the middle of the Black Sea. They were taken off the ship and put into prison. They had to pay 4 rubles as a ransom. And except for the turbulence on the sea, which occurred several times, the trip was without incident. However, he writes, this is again in Shifchei Maran around the travels, a ship full of Greeks that was traveling nearby did sink, and drowning nearly all the passengers. Hashem, in his compassion, let the master and his attendant to their destination. They arrived in peace for the holiday of Shavuos. Now there's Shavuos in Galati, which is near Yasi, where it's in Romania. And again, another epidemic came out. It was and they went from city to city, town to town. They experienced great suffering. It was also difficult for them to cross the border because of the widespread epidemic. The guards, they said, look, we'll come across and we'll quarantine. But they didn't even want to hear about that. They just didn't want to let anybody through. But it doesn't say how here, but Hashem, however, aided them and they were saved from all difficulties. The plagues, war, starvation, thirst, captivity, which they experienced. For Hashem's kindness, they returned in peace in all aspects, physically, materially, and spiritually, for he merited an Eretz Yisrael to reach infinite lofty heights. That was his trip. When he came back, to all who know him, he was renowned for his extraordinary goodness, for he was an embodiment of goodness. This is Shivchei Maran, without any hint of impatience or anger. He merited this while being in Eretz Yisrael. This is what Shivchei Maran said about him. Okay, as soon as he got back, he went to visit Rav Shlomo Zalman of Leidy, because Rav Avram of Kalisk in Eretz Yisrael told him, please, if you could talk to Rav Shlomo Zalman. There was some, again, controversy, some machlokas that was going on between the two of them, and he went. As soon as he came back from Eretz Yisrael, he went to Liadi to visit Rav Shlomo Zalman, spoke to him at length regarding the situation of the people in Eretz Yisrael. For when our master was there, they prevailed upon him to speak. So he had first-hand experience of what was going on, and he spoke to Rav Shlomo Zalman. He gets a letter. This is the letter that was sent to Rav Nachum Breslov from Rav Avram of Kalisk from Tveria. He says, we don't know. He says, the letters, you know, the desperation that was there. He says, we also have no knowledge of what happened in Belarus concerning the issue after His Torah Highness traveled there. We are looking forward for you informing of us of what you did. Okay, we're still in debt, and it goes on to bearing all these terrible pressures that they were still suffering in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, now what happened is the conversation was held at a meal of great controversy. He says about, Rav Nachman said, when he came to Rav Shlomo Zalman, again, there was a controversy. It was about collecting the money and sending it to Eretz Yisrael. And he said that he was there, he saw firsthand what some of the controversies were. One held a certain opinion that the money should be divided this way. Some held it should be divided another way. Some had personal biases. One wanted the emissary to stay by him. Another one wanted the emissary to stay by them. And even in Eretz Yisrael, there was controversy on how to divide up the money. And that's what, I don't know how much, or Nachman, at least he tried to get everything, set things in order. Now, the next thing is, and this became a very, very big controversy, was between him and the Shpala Zayda. The Shpala Zayda was an elder Chassidish Rebbe, and he had a very big following, and it became very, very bad between the two. But here he writes in the Chaim Oran that when they first came, as they were passing, coming from Eretz Yisrael, going home, they stopped by the Shpala Rebbe, and he was receiving with great love. And he made a joyous meal in his honor, and that was the first time they came. And then he says, because of He says, the Shpilla Rebbe says, I usually don't eat supper in the middle of the week, but because you're here, I ate supper. He says, it's going to happen later, we'll just talk about it more, where informants and scandal mongers went to the Shpilla Zaidi and spoke poisonous, and he became an enemy. The Shpilla Rebbe Zaidi, at that point, treated him not with the greatest respect, but we'll see. Now, this is where, this is as we get... In the year 1800, about a year after he came back from Eretz Yisrael, he moved. He decided to move to a place called Zlatopolia. Zlatopolia is a suburb of Shpola, right? It's very close. And basically, what happened is, the way I understand the story. Is there was a it was Yom Kippur, and Ni'ila, somebody got up to daven, and the next thing that happened is he couldn't daven. He like lost his voice. No matter how he tried, he couldn't daven. He had to sit down, and somebody else came up and davened. So sometime later, the Rav Nachman Nachman said, I did it to him. He says, here it was, this is terrible decree from the Russians. The it was called the, where was that again? It says the Prip-Nazia decrees. The Russian government was planning that they would have deprived Jews who were land agents to lose their livelihood. That's one of the things that the Jews did in Russia, is they were land agents. They worked for the pirates, at least in the Poland part of Russia, what was Poland that Russia took over, and they were the land agents, and it was many of them made their parnasa. And the Russians decided there was going to be some decree against it. And Rav Nachman, during Mi'ila, wanted to daven and do things to remove the satan. And he felt that this person who was davening Mi'ila wouldn't allow him to do it. He was not worthy, and because if he would have davened, then Rav Nachman would not have been allowed he would not be able to break the decree. So he silenced him, and he sat down in shame, and that he said, but I had to do it for this decree. Well, this person went to the Shpilla Zaidi. The Shpilla Zaidi heard this, and he went crazy. He said, what? You shame the person for this? I guess the Shpilla Zaidi did not feel that was the correct way of doing things. And I guess as it started and things just kept getting worse and worse, and it became a tremendous controversy. Right? If you only knew, this is what Chaim Aran says about Rav Nachman said, if you only knew how the Satan was standing in the way of our holy endeavor and how he was successful in creating obstacles and turmoil. So when this unqualified man got up to pray, I pushed him away. I silenced him. He became upset. He traveled to the Shpilla Zaidi, and it was a terrible. That's when everything began. The terrible conflict began. Reached the point where almost the entire time was against our master. I've heard from outside stories that the Shpilla Zaidi was just jealous that a new rebbe was coming nearby, and it was a jealousy thing. I don't think it was a jealousy thing. At least this story makes it somewhat, understandable. Like I'm sure there was much more that went on to this. It came even to a point where the Shpilla Zaidi went to Zlatopolia and spoke against Rav Nachman even there. It was despite all this, our master said he was forced to stay there by the will of heaven. Where he was remedying the sin of Yerovam ben Nevat. That's what he said. It's, I don't know how he knew this, but he felt that he had to stay. He was there for 2 years, and he felt that's it. Yerovam ben Nevat's Aveira, he somehow was atoning for it. He remained there for 2 straight years, and even with all that, was drawing more people to him. During this, the renowned Shepetevka made curses against him. Wherever our master heard about the opposition against him, it pained him a lot. Okay, in 1802, so 2 years later, he arrived in Breslau. Okay, and this is where he said this is where he's going to be known from. This is where he had peace, at least in the city. Everywhere else around him, people were talking bad about him. But at least here, that he felt that this is where he's going to make his mark. This is, I think, where Nussen Steinarts met him as we became his Talmud. The more he would draw people close to him, the more opposition would increase. The way he understood it is, I need this opposition to grow in my ruchnius. At least that's the way Reb Nachman would tell people. He would even say, he said, okay, I guess at least Chaim Moran says, had the world not been against Reb Nachman, he could have brought everybody back. He says, Reb Nachman's greatness would have been revealed to the world, he could have brought back them all to Hashem. His life's goal was a constant concern, benefit all man, to bring that to darkness. Now, this, again, this is what he said about himself. I heard from the holy mouth of the following. I can now say all the sages of Israel compared to me are like the skin of a garlic. In Brachas 58a, in Brachas Nun Chesam and Aleph, I forgot who it was that said it. He said, everybody in the world is like a skin of a garlic to me, except this one person. I forgot who it was that said it. But he said, I don't even have an except. Everybody to me is like the skin of a garlic, there's nobody else. There's not even one exception. I'm above everybody. He said that he himself reached the greatest level of humility. I'm the greatest in humility. It's very interesting because there's a Gemara like that said about Rebbe. Rebbe said about himself in the Gemara, you know, when Rebbe died, humility died. You know, and then somebody said, "I vaha, now what about me?" Right? President Gemara said, I'm also a nano. He says, but like humility like Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu knew who he was, and yet he was the greatest anav of all time, anav mikol adam. He expressed himself that his Torah discourses are extraordinary. These are all, he says, why are they against me? Because I am making a new path to serve Hashem. He says, and listen to the way he talks, even if the Baal Shem Tov and the Ariza were alive today, they couldn't compare with me. Because when you talk like this, people don't like it so much. He said, this is where he says, I need constant opposition, for I'm constantly moving up from one level to the next. If I'd be sitting on the same level, I wouldn't even want to live. He also says, I have power to make peace with the whole world, but then I wouldn't have any opposition, and if I don't have opposition, I wouldn't be growing in levels. At least that's the way he viewed the world around him with all this. Again, this is how he viewed other chassidim. He says, I taught our chassidim the ways of our master, that it is not good for a man who consists of mere dash, offer the afer, to excessively engage in merrymaking as is the custom by other chassidim. This is how he was critical of other chassidim. But rather, it would be far better for them to be meticulous in their actions. They should engage in Torah study. I'm just debating because there's so many. I didn't even touch, I'm looking at the time, I didn't even go into any of his sayings, his learning. I'm just thinking maybe we just, if you, the what ended up happening, I'm thinking now maybe we should stop here, and next time we'll talk about, he's going to go to Uman, where he's going to pass away, and then maybe next time we'll talk of some of his sayings and some of his learnings. Any questions? Okay, thank you so much. So that's the next time we'll start, at least with Reb Nachman's, the end of his life, and his learnings and his...